This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. We welcome Linda Thompson to the program, who's author of the historical novel, The Plum Blooms in Winter. How you doing, Linda?
I'm great, Bob. Thank you so much for inviting me on the broadcast today.
Well, good to have you with us, and I'm really interested in this topic, or the history topic that is the basis of your book. Linda Thompson lives near Phoenix, Arizona, has a degree in electrical engineering, and has worked with global technology companies all over the world. She credits her husband, who's an airline pilot, with suggesting she pursue fiction writing some years back. And The Plum Blooms in Winter is her first novel, and it's going to be a trilogy, if you will, called Brands from the Burning Book. The novel, or this one that we're talking about, The Plum Blooms in Winter, is based on a real story from World War II. Can you tell us, Linda, about what was the Doolittle Raid on Japan in 1942?
Sure, I'd love to. It happens to be one of my favorite topics, Bob. So the Doolittle, it's kind of hard for us today to imagine the mindset people were in 1942. So, you know, of course, there'd been the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. But even more than that, we entered the war and the Allies had just experienced really a string of disastrous defeats. The mm-hmm. Japanese really seemed to be winning everywhere. We were just really getting our tushes kicked. And shortly after Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt pulled the military brass together and he said to them, we need to show the world, we need to show our people and we need to show the world that we can get a punch back. So I don't care what it takes, you have to come up with a way to bomb Tokyo. And, you know, it's all right. It can even be a little bit nominal, but we just have to show the world that you know, we can get one in back. And so we were nowhere near Tokyo. You know, there was 2/3 of an ocean between us and Tokyo. And bombers didn't have anything like the kind of range that we think of today. So this seemed insurmountable, but they came up with a very daring, what we would call today, out-of-the-box plan. And this is how it was going to work. Mm-hmm. They were going to put 16 of the Army's medium-weight ground-based bombers onto a carrier, and then a task force was going to take that carrier as close as they could get to Japan, and then these bombers, these ground-based bombers, were going to take off from, it was the USS Hornet, and drop their payloads on, you know, major cities in Japan. But the challenge was, well, first of all, you know, it needed to be proven that these airplanes could take off in the 500 feet that they mm-hmm. would have on the Hornet. They were accustomed to using more than 1,000 feet of runway to put those birds in the sky. But secondly, they knew there was no way that they could land the planes mm-hmm. in 500 feet. So the plan was that the planes were going to drop their bombs over Japan, and then they were going to fly on over occupied eastern China and on to free western China and land on airstrips there. So something like 1,800 miles in range was going to be required for this mission. And, you know, obviously we were assaulting one of the most heavily guarded airspaces in the world. So the men who went knew that that they were definitely up against a challenge. It was a volunteer mission. And the men who went knew that they were really up against the challenge.
Yeah, I would say, in fact, we associate, I mean, it really wasn't a suicide attack, but we associate suicide attacks with the Japanese. But this was a very dangerous mission for these pilots, and a number of them did die, and others were taken prisoner. But I guess most of them found their way back to the American lines or whatever.
Well, here's where all the drama unfolds, really. You know, so we were talking earlier, Bob. I mean, the raid was militarily very significant. Even though we didn't do a lot of damage, the fact that we showed that we were able to bomb Japan really shaped the strategy of the Japanese and helped draw them into Midway, you know, which became really the turning point in the war in the Pacific. So the Doolittle Raid really did set us up to succeed in the war, even though the raid itself was you know, we did hit quite a number of military targets, but it was kind of a drop in the bucket. But the fact that we proved we had that capability really shaped the strategy of the Japanese. But the point you're getting at is, although the actual raid on Japan was surprisingly successful, none of the planes were shot down, all of them successfully deployed their payloads on military targets, but the part where they were supposed to land in China, that was where all the drama came in,
right.
because none of those planes actually found their landing strips. And now, so, go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe I should ask you about who was Doolittle. That was ultimately General James Doolittle, who was a great aviation pioneer. I was reading about him. I think he helped create instrument flying.
Yes, he was very instrumental. Yeah, he was, at that time, he was one of the world's most famous aviators. His aviation career started in World War One, but he was very frustrated because in World War One he wound up just being an instructor and never saw combat. And so he kind of carried that with him. In the 30s, he won several. He basically won every aviation trophy there was, which, of course, those were the glory glamour days of aviation. So he was a household name. He carried away all of these trophies. He did aerobatics and acrobatics. And, yes, he had he went on to get a doctorate at MIT. So he was also, in addition to being very brave, he was very brilliant. And he was, in fact, very instrumental, quote unquote, in pioneering instrument flight, which is what has made, you know, commercial aircraft and military aircraft really possible to the degree that they are today.
And this, as you say, this raid accomplished something, a goal that President Roosevelt had set to do something to attack Japan. And it really had a great morale-building effect in the United States, and honestly, you know, propaganda value. My producer Dave was telling me he's a great fan of movies. I didn't realize they had done a movie about this, and it came out in 1944 while the war was still on.
Right. Yes, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. They actually did four movies, but 30 Seconds Over Tokyo was you know, you can still see it. It's broadcast pretty regularly today. And I think it was I think it was the Top Gun of its era. You know, it actually gave people an inside look at, you know, the cutting edge military technology of the day. So it was pretty exciting stuff.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about your story, the story you tell in the novel, The Plum Blooms in Winter. Will you explain what that means? Or
certainly. So, like I mentioned earlier, none of the planes actually found their landing strips. All of them either bailed out or crash landed. What the movie 30 Seconds Over Tokyo shows is the fact that most of those men were, you know, collected by the Chinese resistance and smuggled out of occupied China and into free China. And, you know, then those men were able to, for the most part, get back to the war. And there were actually surprisingly few casualties. There were some, but given the dangerous level of the mission, there were surprisingly few. However, two of the crews were captured by the Japanese. And so that's the story my novel follows. It follows the story of Jimmy Doolittle's lost crews. They were in Japanese prison, POW camps, for 40 months. So, you know, everything that you may have seen in the movie Unbroken, you know, they experienced that for 40 months. They experienced systematic torture, you know, routine beatings, starvation, all of that. And only four of those eight men actually came home. So it was a horrible experience for all of them. But
did you say Doolittle himself was held that long or no?
No. Doolittle was among the 13 crews who were smuggled out of China successfully. And yeah, he got back to the war and he got an immediate promotion to brigadier general. And as you pointed out, ended the war as a lieutenant general. So he went on to have a brilliant career through the rest of the war.
And one of
my story follows, like we mentioned, lost crews. So they had this horrible, horrible experience. And somewhere in the middle of it all, they were given a Bible. And at this point, they had been mostly in solitary confinement, so just sitting around all day with nothing to do. But somewhere in the middle of all of this, they were given a Bible. And it really was, you know, we talked about the value of a morale boost. It really was the morale boost that got them through the war. And one of those men was so changed by what he read in the Bible that he wanted to come back to the war, or to come back to Japan after the war as a missionary, because he wanted to show the Japanese people God's forgiveness. He wanted to become a walking object lesson. So he wanted to show them, look, I went through all of this in the war, and yet here I have come back to Japan, you know, to share what I believe with you.
Now two points.
That's what my novel kind of follows his story.
2 points, if I could. This book is the genre, is it called Christian mystery and Christian adventure or something like that?
Well, it's historical fiction. I guess I would call it a suspense story.
But, I mean, your appeal, to some extent anyway, is to Christians, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes.
people of faith. Could be other faiths as well. I kind of lost the other point I was going to ask you about, but let me just return to the story itself. So I know what I was going to ask you. For example, this man who becomes your main character, who has this religious experience because he gets a Bible. I mean, is he, quote unquote, a real person, or is this a fictional creation of yours?
So that's a little complicated. His story is based on, I don't want to say based on, but inspired by a real person. The real person was a man named Jake DeShazer, who was from Salem, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And he did, in fact, go back to Japan after the war as a missionary. He had grown up in a very fundamentalist Christian household, but he walked away from that in high school. He had no use for it. But then when he was alone with the Bible for weeks at a time, he kind of rediscovered the value of what he had left behind. And so, yes, that's all real. Jake DeShazer went back to Japan as a missionary after the war. The other part of my novel that is, you know, based on a true incident, there was a young woman who learned that he was coming to her city, and the Doolittle raid had killed a man that she loved. And so based on the belief system in the militarist belief system in Japan at the time, she was duty bound in her mind to revenge herself upon him. And so as soon as she heard that this former Doolittle raider was coming to her city, she made plans to assassinate him. And in fact, she showed up at one of his meetings with a knife in her purse and every intention of taking him out if she could. And so that's where the suspense comes in. That's the incident that my novel is based on. It really did happen.
Can you say in real life, did the woman actually kill the man or attack him? Or
in real life, she never actually attacked him.
Okay.
And so that's why this is a novel.
Sure.
Because, of course, in a novel, you come up with a dramatic take on events. In real life, she did not attack him. But in real life, she did attend his meetings 2 or 3 times, trying to decide exactly what she was going to do.
We're talking with Linda Thompson. She is author of a historical novel, The Plum Blooms in Winter, based on events involving America's Doolittle raid, the raid that James Doolittle led, aviation pioneer, the first time that America attacked Japan from the air. We'll be back with Linda in just a moment. You're listening to the Historians Podcast, and our Historians Podcast GoFundMe Drive is underway, and we certainly would appreciate a donation, any size. Go to this GoFundMe page. It's GoFundMe.com/2019-the-historians. If you'd rather not donate online, you could just write me a check. I make out a check to Bob Cudmore and send to 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. Our guest is Linda Thompson, author of the historical novel The Plum Blooms in Winter, which is based upon events around the Doolittle raid in 1942 in World War II. So once the planes cross, you know, over Japan, the American planes, and then cross the sea, a little bit of the sea again. They're over the mainland in China, and you said, I think they all crashed, I believe is what you said. But I wanted to correct that if necessary. But what I wanted to ask you about, I think the only one who didn't crash, right, was the guy who, not really, I don't know if it was by mistake, but he went to Russia, and Russia didn't want these planes to go there.
Okay, well, I'd love to tell that story, as a matter of fact, because Ed York was the pilot of that. That was plane number 8. Ed York was the pilot of plane number 8, and in fact, he's from your area. He grew up in Batavia and graduated from Batavia High School in 1928. So there had been some unauthorized tweaks made to the planes in McClellan Air Force Base, and they plane number 8 was burning fuel a whole lot faster than it was supposed to. And they noticed this early on and realized that they had a problem and calculated that they weren't going to get within 300 miles of China. Mm. You know, so they did not have a good option at that point. You know, bring the plane down in Japan, no, not a good option. Crash 300 miles from shore, also not a good option. So the best idea they could come up with was to take the plane to Russia. And so, yes, they were the only ones who actually landed on an actual airfield. Right. The only problem was that it was in Russia rather than in China where they were supposed to be.
And I was reading again in Wikipedia or other sources that, as I understand it, that this was a tough, almost like diplomatic issue, because the Russians were, or the USSR was fighting the Germans. They were not fighting the Japanese. And apparently Stalin had moved practically all of his troops to the Western front to fight the Germans. And he didn't want to have trouble on his eastern border with Japan. So I don't know if Roosevelt or if, you know, the Americans asked the Russians for permission, but they said, "Niet." I mean, we can't do this. But now they're kind of stuck with these Americans, and what did they do? Eventually, they were able to get out.
That's a fabulous story. So yeah, it was definitely a case of asking forgiveness rather than permission, because they didn't anticipate that anyone was going to land in Russia. And you're exactly right. The Russians were not at war with the Japanese and didn't want to risk antagonizing the Japanese at that point in time. So the Americans kind of expected that the Russians would refuel them and send them on their way, but the Russians declined. and so the Americans, the 5 crew members of plane number 8 wound up interned in Russia for 13 months. They were moved a couple of times to keep them. They were treated reasonably kindly. They were moved a couple of times to keep them out of the way of the German advance. And then after about 13 months, somewhere in the middle of that, they're sitting in Siberia in the middle of the winter with temperatures at 50 degrees below zero. And they literally decided to write Stalin a letter. And they couched it all very politely, but basically said, gee, you know, we'd really like to get back to the war against our mutual enemies. Could you please release us? Or failing that, could you move us further south and give us some work to do? Because we would like to be useful to the war effort. Well, it was months before they got an answer to that letter, but eventually a major showed up where they were staying and informed them that their letter had made its way to the Russian high command. And he said, kindly and politely, we can't release you, but, you know, we will grant your other requests. So they moved them way further south and gave them kind of menial jobs on a production line. But once they got, the town they got moved to was in Turkmenistan, very close to the Iranian border. So once they got there, they discovered that they were kind of loosely guarded and they were kind of in a position where they could make friends. And eventually they were able to bribe an Arab smuggler to take them across the border into Iran. And it all reads like a wonderful adventure story. You know, that would make a good novel itself. But looking back on it, they always sort of wondered if, in fact, their circumstances had been engineered so that they would be allowed to escape.
It almost sounds it.
And in fact, some documents eventually got declassified, and that is, in fact, what happened. They were allowed to escape.
Now, going to Iran today for an American doesn't sound like a great thing, but at the time, the Russians or the USSR and Britain were kind of in control of Iran.
Right. And so they were able to, they got dropped off 4 miles from a small city that had a British consulate. So they kind of had to sneak by some sentries that were guarding the entrance to the city, but they were able to do that successfully and just walk into the British consulate. And then they went back to the war. Ed, in fact, got assigned to Italy, where he flew 31 B-17 missions and, you know, went on to have a very good career with the Air Force.
And Doolittle ended up being a general, right, commanding the American airplanes over North Africa, I think.
Yes. Yeah, Doolittle entered the war as a lieutenant general responsible for the 8th Air Force in England. So obviously that was a pretty big command.
Yeah. Now, back to your book for a moment, or the setup of your book, The Plum Blooms in Winter. You have a character who is and this is after the war, he's touring Japan as an evangelist, and he was one of the members of the Doolittle raid. But the person who feels it's her duty to kill him, I don't know if this was true in real life, but you make her a prostitute. Why is that?
So not much is known. Actually, when I started the book, I had the idea that I was going to write, you know, something more like narrative nonfiction, just really sticking to the facts of the story. But the challenge was that this young woman who wanted to assassinate my missionary, not much is known about her from history. So she really kind of had to be a fictional character. And in fact, she is a composite character of about three different women that Jake mentions that he met in his biography. He describes a woman that he met who was a prostitute, who was converted to Christianity and gave that up. So this and so I'm going to create this fictional character. So you try to understand the context and understand what's going on in history. And what I learned is that, in fact, a very large number of women in Japan in that time were driven into prostitution. There were something like 100,000 mm-hmm. prostitutes in the Tokyo area. So I tried to base her on, you know, historical situations that a woman like that could, you know, very likely have found herself in. And unfortunately, prostitution was definitely one of them.
Hmm. We're talking with Linda Thompson, author of The Plum Blooms in Winter. You mentioned about Edward York hailing from Batavia in western New York state. And there was at least another Doolittle raider from New York state, and that was a guy from Long Island?
Yes, that's right. So George Barr was one of Doolittle's lost crews that I was mentioning, the story that I follow in my novel with the men who were in prison in Japan for 40 months. George Barr was one of those. And yeah, he was from Brooklyn. He was one of the four who survived. But unfortunately, when they were released in August of 1945, he was the one who was in the worst condition. George Barr was 6'2" and a redhead. So to the Japanese, he was just a freak. You know, they found redheads very strange. And so he probably got even worse treatment than the rest of the men did. Hmm. So he was very weakened. And all of them, 40 months spent mostly in solitary confinement, malnourished. None of them were in very good shape mentally. And George Barr had just really declined. So he was not able to leave China when the rest of the raiders did. He was not in good enough health to make the trip. And then unfortunately, he kind of got lost in the system. He was delusional. He was put in, the typical treatment for mentally ill patients at the time were things like straitjackets and padded rooms and solitary confinement. And so that happened to George Barr, and all of it just really triggered him because it took him right back to his experience with the Japanese. And he wound up convinced that he was still in prison. And he was delusional. And so he was telling people that he was a Doolittle raider, but they figured that was just part of his delusion. Hmm. So eventually he got back to the United States, but nobody knew who he was. He got back to the United States with no baggage, no ID tags, and telling everybody this crazy story about having been a Doolittle raider, which nobody believed. And so it was a couple of years before he recovered enough to return to civilian life. So it is, but the good news is he did recover completely. He married, you know, he lived a good life, but it took him a couple years to get there. And ultimately, Doolittle himself had to get personally involved. A person who had sort of been George's unofficial foster mom wrote a letter to Doolittle, just, you know, expressing her heart about the fact that George, you know, the other raiders that had survived this experience had all come home, but George had not. And where was George? And so Doolittle set out an inquiry into it. And at that point, like we say, he was a general. So he set out he personally set out an inquiry into what had happened to George Barr. And so between George's foster mom and Doolittle, they tracked him down, and Doolittle went to see him. He was at that point in a hospital in Iowa. And Doolittle went to see him and said that he had never been so angry in his entire life as when he heard what had happened to George Barr. So he got that all. He, you know, definitely told everyone, yes, this was a Doolittle raider. This is one of my men. And he got all of those things righted and got George his back pay and his promotion and put everything to rights personally. But yeah, George, it was really tragic. He was lost in the system for a couple of years.
Linda Thompson with us. The Plum Blooms in Winter is her book. We're almost out of time. And I asked you this already, what the title means, but and you answered it. But is that like, it almost sounds like code, The Plum Blooms in Winter. And is that?
I never did really answer that. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. So it's actually based on a sort of a Japanese idiom isn't quite the term, but it's a saying in Japanese, and it has to do with flowers are important in Japanese culture, and they're not girly. You know, even the samurai had emblems that came from flowers, and the cherry blossom is admired especially, but before the cherry blooms in April, the plum blooms, and the buds will actually push through the frost, and the plum blooms in like February. So the plum blossom is a symbol of hardiness because it blooms through the frost. And so, you know, cherry blossoms may be stunning in their beauty, but when you've seen a plum bloom in winter, that is a sight that you won't soon forget because it's just such a symbol of hardiness and persistence. And I felt like that really epitomized both of my characters. It epitomized the Doolittle Raiders who, you know, survived through their 40 months of incarceration. And I felt like it also epitomized my female character, who was just such a fighter in spite of everything that she had suffered during the war.
Linda Thompson is working on a follow-up novel, which will be called The Mulberry Leaf Whispers. I'm not going to ask you to explain that. We don't have time, but I'm sure that it has a meaning as well. The Plum Blooms in Winter is published by Mountain Brook, Inc. The author is Linda Thompson. You can find her online. It really has been a pleasure talking with you, and it's a fascinating story about the Doolittle Raid.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's been great talking to you as well, and just a pleasure to share with your listeners.
You've been listening to the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.